This is episode 1-6 of the Software Freedom Law Show. And thanks for joining us again. Today, we're back with a listener-driven show.
Yeah, I realized I haven't been saying the email address to contact us, and therefore that may be the reason we haven't gotten lots of listener requests, although we've gotten a few, and this one actually came via Identica directly to me from a guy named, I met him actually at the...
And we always appreciate any listener feedback at all, so thank you very much.
And please give us feedback, and podcast@softwarefreedom.org is the email address, and you can find me on Identica as well.
I'm on Identica too, but I don't post as often.
And she doesn't really pay attention, because I have to tell her when somebody says something to her, so I have had to do that, because you don't check it that often.
Occasionally, when somebody actually speaks, like actually identifies me, I get notification.
Oh, yeah. You see the email. Yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah. So that's true.
Right. So anyway, so you were telling the story about how.
Oh, so this fellow is. I met him at the conference they do every year at York College in Canada, in Toronto. It was outside of Toronto, actually. And there's a lot of Canadian free software developers there. And I don't get to go every year, but I went last year. It's actually coming up again soon, I think. But I won't be there this year. But last year I met this fellow named Dan Scott, who works on, I think, a really important project. I've often said that we need people to find areas where proprietary software is in complete control and where the free software model works really perfectly. And what he did was discovered that in the library cataloging systems, this was a perfect place because libraries don't have a lot of money to spend on large proprietary software systems. Once you write a software system once, it can be adapted for other places much more cheaply than it would be if to write it again from scratch as proprietary software or to license some proprietary software. So he started I'm not sure if he started it, but he's heavily involved with a system called Evergreen, which is a library cataloging system.
Oh, really neat.
And so that's his project. That's what he does. And he gets funded to do improvements to it and deploy it at various libraries around the world. And that's
really fabulous.
So it's a fully free software thing. And he was asking me a while back, actually, about what license to use for their documentation.
And this is a question we get quite often.
Right. And it's confusing because there are code examples in documentation and there is text, regular text, like a book that's often in documentation. So people are unsure what license to apply. And even way back when I got my first job at the FSF in 1999, answering FSF's general contact email, back in a time before websites were really the way you got in touch with people and you would send email.
Dinosaurs roam the earth?
Dinosaurs didn't roam the earth, but every webpage had an email address and people would send you a lot of emails. So I used to answer the general contact email at FSF, and this would be a question we got every few weeks about this issue.
Oh, what to do about documentation. Yeah. I think also a lot of people didn't really think about it and just started using licenses that weren't necessarily that appropriate for documentation.
Well, and part of that was because licenses early in our community didn't really exist as far as being designed specifically for documentation. There weren't really licenses available that specifically covered the issue of documentation.
Right, and the problem is if you try to use software licenses to apply to documentation, then you're giving me then there are a lot of provisions that sometimes apply very awkwardly and strangely to documentation.
Well, I was remembering this rule of thumb we used to use, which probably wasn't a very good one, honestly, which was that the GPL was fine for documentation as long as there was clearly something that was could be called the source code.
Ah.
Which is not really the best advice. But since FSF didn't have a documentation license, I suppose that was the easiest thing to say.
Right, and I think that a lot of those problems were tackled in the FDL.
Yeah, I think that's generally true. I mean, the FDL, the FDL is difficult for me to talk about because it was a very painful license to get out the door. I had just started working for FSF when we were beginning FDL, so I was only involved marginally in its drafting, and I saw a few of the terms early on that Stallman was working on for it. And one of the problems that the FDL had was that it was done in a very special moment in free software history, I think. It was right at this moment where free software was getting a lot of adoption. This is like 2000. So it's free software is really starting to get heavy adoption for the first time, basically, in the history of free software. And there was a lot of interest to write books about it. A lot of people wanted to have a license that was free for the books that was being written about free software. Certainly the FSF did, and even other folks. There was a thing floating around called the Open Publication License, mm-hmm. and there was a number of different weird licenses floating around. And the complexity of negotiating with publishers about mm-hmm. what rights the author has and what people can do with the book and how it can be copied and various other things really influenced in weird ways I think what became the FDL and what became a lot of the documentation licenses from that era in history, which is now about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think the FDL is an interesting license, but I think there are certain things in it that various places in our community have been unhappy yeah. with.
Mm-hmm. You're referring to the Debian legal.
Yeah, and so one thing that the FSF, so the other weird thing was that the FSF was also a publisher of books and was one of the ways the FSF was funded during the 1990s. So there was this history in the FSF to be worried about how you made money in publishing and so forth. So in some ways that was really helpful because the FSF and O'Reilly, who were really the main publishers, mm-hmm. had a lot of conversations about building the FDL and how to make it work so that O'Reilly could adopt it, so that FSF could use it. But there were also these confusions about how works were assembled. For example, and this is where the Debian thing comes in, the FSF always put copies of the GNU Manifesto and other essays about free software and the politics of free software into the manuals as a way of making sure that people learned something about the philosophy mm-hmm. and history of free software and why it was important to have software freedom and all these other things when they read a technical manual, which I think is actually a very laudable goal and a mm-hmm. good idea. Mm-hmm. The problem was those essays were works of someone's personal ideas mm-hmm. and therefore modifying them means you could change what the person said or make it represent like the person said right. something different.
And maybe this is a funny time to sort of talk about our own discussion about what we were going to, how we wanted to handle licensing for our podcast, because this is sort of the same issue yeah, where but, I'm concerned sure, that someone might that. Take something that one of us says out of context. And, you know, and especially since yeah, I'm a lawyer, I'm obviously always very conservative about this kind of thing and worried about being understood and being taken in context. And the problem with these kinds of mediums for expressing ideas in this way are that, you know, that you can take a piece and it will mislead somebody as to what the whole was. And I think that that's sort of the concern when you're looking at the GNU Manifesto. If you take a sentence, it might not, you know, it might not really convey the whole.
Right, and it's completely a valid point, and which is why I ultimately agreed with you that we could do no derivative works for this podcast.
But if you'd like to make a derivative work, just contact us.
Yeah. See, I guess my influence on that was growing up listening to rather not great 80s radio and how they used to cut interviews and stuff and use little spots of it to make funny things about politicians and all that sort of thing. I always thought it would be the ultimate in fame if you actually had somebody cutting up and adding.
Well, that would probably be fair use.
Probably, so. although sometimes they were rather long segments. So there's, I don't know where does the line cross? You know, if you take relatively long segments to do that with. Mm-hmm.
We've talked about this before on the show.
I know, I think, but I forget all the time.
Yeah,
I'm
no.
Sorry.
Well, it's a balancing test, and there's no easy checklist. I mean, there's a checklist, but there's no standard test each time. You have to look at is the use, what's the purpose of the use? Is it commercial or is it non-commercial? Is it educational? Is there a parody component to it? Is it being used for news or criticism? How much of the whole are you using and how essential that part is? There are all these little pieces that are you add them together and you determine whether, is it or isn't it. And it's kind of frustrating, I think, in some ways, because non-lawyers say, well, how do you lawyers know? And if you can't tell us exactly how we know, then, how do we know that's a reliable, repeatable test? Mm-hmm. And, I think a lot of lawyers have the response of, well, actually, when you apply these criteria that we've discussed at great length, it in effect becomes a test and you know it when you see it. And you'll see that, if you go through a couple of cases, most of the cases are very clear. It's pretty obvious when it's fair use and pretty obvious when it's not fair use. And then there are a lot of areas on the, you know, on the border that many of us would err towards saying that they are fair use. But
well, I think that it's somewhat useful to have the derivative works permission even when you don't need it, just because then you know you're in clear territory and you never have to think about it. You never have to do the analysis because you have derivative works permission.
I'm a big fan of granting permission for derivative works. Mm-hmm. I'm just, you know, when there's a legal component or a policy statement or something like that.
And this is exactly to bring us back to the point, which we kind of got off on it. That's exactly the challenge that was being faced with the FDL and why there's a thing in the FDL called the invariant sections, mm-hmm. which you can declare certain parts of the work that they cannot be technically generally useful informational material. They must be political or policy statements. Mm-hmm. You can declare them in invariant sections, and they aren't modifiable, and they aren't removable downstream as well, depending on how you use the section. So I think a lot of people were very bothered by this and felt that this wasn't really free licensing in the sense of freedom, because you didn't have the freedom to modify that part of the work. So actually, Debian made the decision that they would accept FDL'd works, but only if they had no invariant sections in their clause in the work, and the basically the invariant sections clause was not exercised.
I think it actually is really valuable to have that discussion of, you know, where on the line is free and where, you know, where isn't it. So. And I think that's an understandable position to take.
Having been part of I was part of the drafting FDL is overstating. I was around when FDL was getting drafted, mm-hmm. and I watched it happen from a front row seat. That's probably my involvement in FDL. But having been in that seat and watched it happen and watched how the negotiations with O'Reilly happened to get a license that O'Reilly could accept. Yeah, I look back now and I think I can see Debian's side of it. I actually pretty much agree with Debian and think that the invariant sections are this weird artifact of something that we were trying to do with the GNU manuals back in the day. That when you look at it with the eyes of history, you're like, well, was that really that important to make a fight with Debian about? And, mm-hmm. and probably it wasn't. And I think a lot of the license, and FDL is not unique in this, I think it's called the Open Publication License. Nobody uses it anymore, really. Has the same sort of weirdness with certain clauses you can exercise and certain clauses you don't. And it's a free license when you don't exercise them, but if you do, it's not. And all those sorts of things. I think looking at that 1999 2000 to 2001 era of documentation license writing, we see artifacts, basically. Just mm-hmm. like when you look at GPLv2, you see this pre-internet distribution artifacts in it because it thinks about distribution in terms of copying CDs and so forth. It's the same sort of thing with these licenses. They're of their time.
And these actually, this sort of touches on why there is a strong argument to license, to grant some wiggle room in the licenses for so-called upgrading to later forms.
Or later stuff.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, is that, you know, so choosing a license or later and giving the organization that published the license the ability to publish a new version that handles situations that couldn't have been anticipated when the license was first drafted can be very useful for that purpose. There are reasons you might not want to do or later, but that's a really good reason, and this is the kind of thing. Now, and there is a new version of the FDL.
Well, yeah, and that's an interesting. That's probably the most mm-hmm. interesting and almost exciting, I think, use of an or later clause, because this came into discussion with Wikipedia. Wikipedia was started right around that time when FDL had just come out, and Jimmy basically jumped on the FDL excitedly because he was waiting almost for a license that he could use for Wikipedia that would work. And of course this
copyleft
was
copyleft allows derivative works, keeps it free.
Voila. And GPL clearly wasn't right.
Was a great license for that. Yeah.
GPL clearly wasn't right. So FDL was a great option when it came out for him. But as I was just saying, it has these artifacts of its time, and it was before Creative Commons was even started as an organization and so forth. It almost cemented Wikipedia in this certain moment in time. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, he had used the or later clause.
Right.
With all Wikipedia contributions licensing FDL v1.2 or later. Mm-hmm. And therefore they were able to upgrade. And what happened is the FSF, as the licensing steward, heard from the Wikipedia community very clearly after lots of discussion and negotiation that they really needed to allow move to Creative Commons license, because Creative Commons licensing, particularly CC BY SA, which is the Creative Commons Attribution Share and Share Alike license, that license was really the central license people were using for things to teach people, things to explain how various things work.
And also, it's a
it sounds like I'm one. Sorry, I'm mad for a second. It sounds like I'm one. Remember Pyramid, the game show, where to say things that.
Oh,
that's what I was saying. The way I was talking, it sounded like I was on Pyramid with Dick Clark.
That's funny.
So, but yeah, I didn't mean to.
Don't think we're gonna win $10,000.
But it would be
was
cool.
Was it $10,000 or is it more?
Wasn't it the $1 million? I don't remember. They brought it back a few times, and of course, inflation, the money kept going up. So at any given time, when it was on in the 70s and 80s, it was probably was $10,000 in those days.
What I was gonna say is just that I think that what Creative Commons has been successful at, and this is, you know, one of the fascinating things to me about the history between, you know, of the free software movement and the free culture movement, is that the free culture movement really finds its roots in free software. So the idea of copyleft got developed in the free software context. And then through situations like this, it began being applied to, you know, to documentation and subsequently literature and things like that. And when Creative Commons did come along, one of the things that they've done really well is explain their licenses in a way that people can understand. So what they've done is that while they have a lot of different licenses that do a lot of different things, they have, well, you know, and there are some downsides to this too, but they have, you know, they have little pictures and little very brief explanations of what the licenses do. And that helps people sort of understand the really important decisions that they're making by choosing one of those licenses. And so beyond the actual terms of the license, what Creative Commons has done is it's made people really comfortable with the idea of using different licenses. And I think it's really very clever, the some rights reserved idea. It really gets it gets the idea across in a really effective way. And so you know, one of the things about the Creative Commons licenses is just that people are comfortable with them now. Now I think calling the brief summary human readable summary, I think is what they call it, and then having the legal code makes it sound like the legal code is something that people really can't read, which is something that I really like about the FSF, is that every license that the FSF publishes, they really make an effort to make it readable and to make it, you know, to make it understandable to just anyone. And I think that it's an attempt, you know, whether or not it's successful in every clause in every license, I don't know, but, you know, and many people would argue no, but I remember the first time, you know, I saw the GPL and, you know, read it as a human being and, you know, was really moved by it. And I think that's really, that's something else, you know, and those two things are really interesting. So what's interesting in this whole FDL context is that, you know, there sort of was this acknowledgement for Wikipedia that, that having a license that people were more comfortable with and was, you know, maybe more appropriate in a couple of different ways for that particular circumstance, you know, made sense in making it easy to upgrade to get that accomplished.
Yeah, I think it was an admission that the FDL wasn't a perfect license for all types of works of information, basically, of generally useful technical information, as Stallman often puts it. I think that it's so funny that people often give FSF such a hard time for being rigid, and that was a great example of where they gave in and said, people prefer CC BY SA. It's a copyleft. We should let people move to it from FDL and give people an opportunity to move their works. If they have multiple contributors and it's difficult for them to get all the copyright holders to choose, let them move those works to a license
and
they
it's
like
so
better.
It's so clever to do it in the license that way, I think it's so clever. It's like, you know, you can have this license or an upgraded version of this license. And in the upgraded version of the license, so in the next version of the same license, you know, it could say you could actually, upgrading it means you can actually, you know, use a different license altogether. Yep. Well, the nice thing about giving nonprofits the power to do that or the ability to do that is that they are nonprofits and they're obligated to operate in the public interest. And so when you give an organization like the FSF the ability to say or later, it means that, that, you're trusting an organization that is actually limited in what they could do. They're organized to promote free and open source software. They're an advocacy organization.
Sorry, the FSF's not organized to promote open source software. FSF's organized to promote only free software.
Fair enough, but they're...
If for no other reason, they were incorporated before a decade and a half before
true, and I apologize. I say that to be inclusive. And you're right, it was wrong.
Only in that narrow little context.
Right. Absolutely. But nonetheless, the Free Software Foundation has its nonprofit purpose.
Yeah.
And so as someone putting your trust in the Free Software Foundation that they can't make the next version of the license a proprietary license. Mm-hmm. Now there are different ideas about what you can do within that nonprofit mission, but you can entrust it in the same way that Creative Commons is a nonprofit and they too are bound by their nonprofit mission. So when you do that, it's different than giving a company.
Yep. I'm gonna make this point once more, to which I've now belabored a little bit, but I think when you look at FDL, the reason that this was needed, this sort of new innovative, somewhat drastic way of relicensing down the line was needed, was that the FDL actually predates a period where there was a community process for license development. We didn't really think about that in the old days, that we had to get the whole community involved in license development the way GPLv3 right. was done. And that's why FDL has this sort of, the publishers were very listened to, but maybe the community, Debian certainly wasn't as listened to as it should have been in the early days of FDL. And I think that the license itself has those artifacts in it.
Has Creative Commons had a public licensing? A public comment period on their licenses? I don't think they have. Have they?
That's unfortunate if they haven't.
I haven't thought about it. I know I've seen drafts when they've bounced around, and I know I've heard discussions about drafts, but I don't know if it's been a formalized process.
Yeah, and I brought this up just to connect it up to something, which is that although the FSF being an organization with limited resources, they have not been moving as quickly as any of us would like, but that's purely a resource issue. They do have a simple FDL draft up for comment. And that process is ongoing. Mm-hmm. It just hasn't been a highest priority. And, you have to be forgiving of all of us in the nonprofit world. We have really limited resources and we get done as much work as we can, but we can't move as quickly as we'd like to on everything. But that doesn't mean that it's not still something FSF will eventually do. And it's still open for comment. You can go and post comment on the SFDL, which is the simple, free documentation license. And the design, I think, is trying to really get some of these goofy publisher focused paper printing things from the FDL, right. which are moot in a lot of ways now for various reasons. But also, I think the FDL, looking back on it historically, was a little too publisher friendly and not enough friendly to the average reader, for example, because I think the FDL is very difficult to understand. There's a lot of terms in it. There's a lot of options you can exercise. There's a lot of things that don't matter until you do them, and then there are complex rules you have to follow. Yeah. And I think that I used to joke that we were going to get really bad if there's a whole section FDL where they go to letters, and it's A through, I think it goes to P. And I was joking that eventually we're going to get to AA, and then we'll know the FDL is truly broken. And we have to have AA, this thing. But we're almost to the alphabet,
I want to follow up on my point earlier, which is I don't think I got across, which is when I was saying that it's, when I was applauding the FSF for making it an attempt to have the licenses readable, by ordinary people who aren't lawyers. I actually, as part of that, I wanted to encourage our listeners to go ahead and, if you're listening to our podcast, it's because you have an interest in legal issues in free and open source software, and this is appropriate to say open source now. but you care about these legal issues. So if you haven't taken a look at the licenses, go ahead and actually read them, because, sometimes there may be terms that are a little hard to understand and there may be legalese in there, but really anybody can read a license. And I think it's a real problem when people think, well, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't read this license. You should take a look at it and see, and give it a basic read. I actually think that it's very helpful.
Yeah, and I use myself as an example in this. I'm not a lawyer, and people often think that I am. They get confused. some lawyers don't take me seriously because I'm not. But the thing is that the law is not magic. I don't mean to be insulting to your profession, Karen, but the fact of the matter is all you guys did was go to school for an extra 3 years to learn something specific.
We did, but
and take an exam.
We didn't really learn the, I mean, most of us, if you go to a, this is a secret. If you go to one of the top law schools, you don't really actually learn the law you're going to practice. So going to law school doesn't mean that you really learn what the law is. You learn a lot about, you read a bunch of cases, you learn some principles, you learn legal analysis, you talk about these esoteric ideas, and you talk about, you know, legal reform. But when it comes down to it, I learned very little actual law at Columbia Law School. I don't think any professor at Columbia Law School would be shocked to hear me say that. Mm. But so what we do is we honed a lot of our tools that were, you know, allow us to understand and interpret the law. But really it's just the time that we spend getting to know the law since we've graduated from law school that gives us that ability. And since you've spent all this time also becoming familiar with the law, you have, you know, you know a lot more about, I've said this before, about a lot of these topics than many admitted lawyers.
Well, I certainly don't know anything about probate and and various other areas of
it's
law.
It's funny when people ask me questions about areas that I don't practice in. I always say, you want a real lawyer for that. But then it's funny because someone who's practicing in that field will say, when you ask them about a real estate copyright, question, they'll say, oh, you'll need a real lawyer for that. Yeah. So it goes around and around.
So I'm pretty confined in the copyright patent.
Well, we find our specialties, but you know. But all that is learning everything that we can about that particular topic.
Yeah, and the thing is that every field is like this. There are things I learned in graduate school in computer science that Karen sat down and learned during the GCC process, and she, you know, you constantly claim you don't get, you feel like you don't get it, but you actually get it better than some people who sat next to me in class in advanced compiler optimizations.
That saddens me a little.
No, but the thing is that I used to say this when somebody was asking me something about economics and I was like, well, yeah, I could look at all that stuff and like, well, it takes so long, it's so hard or something. And I was like, well, anything that's written down, a human invented, basically.
Right.
So I'm a human being and I have at least average intelligence. Therefore, I should have a pretty good chance of.
Yeah. I was actually, it's funny because this is my theory for, I refinished a dresser and I had no idea anything about stripping paint or any of this. And my mother asked me, what are you doing? And I said, if people can do it, I can do it.
Yeah,
and it's
exactly
kind of the
correct.
Same thing. Now, right. I don't want to say that there aren't circumstances where you need a lawyer who has the experience of all of that learning. And you need someone for certain things that is actually admitted to a bar to practice, you know, for reasons. And there are situations where you'll want to contact a lawyer like the Software Freedom Law Center. And, you know, we exist for a reason and we fill a need and we're valuable.
And to translate this to computer science speak, you wouldn't want to hire a C++ programmer to do your system administration, right? You just wouldn't, even though they probably are just as able to learn system administration. They don't know it. So it's the same
time.
Sort of thing. You should get an expert. But to take us back to the discussion of doc licensing, I think that it is complicated in the sense that there are often different licenses used, and a lot of people bring up this issue of code examples, and they want to pull examples of code from the software, which, as you mentioned, probably often could be fair use, mm-hmm. which means they could pull examples from the code, put it in the documentation, even put it under a different copyright.
Right.
But one of the things that I've often encouraged projects to do, and I think it's not a bad idea, is to use disjunctive licensing and just license your documentation under GPL and say CC by SA. Or something like that. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when people ask me, I just want an answer. Just tell me what the best doc license is. I usually tell them disjunctive with GPL v3 or later, CC by SA 2.0 or later. Because I think that's a really easy solution.
And why don't you explain
solution.
What you mean by disjunctive?
So this was actually a licensing idea invented by Larry Wall, which I think he deserves the credit for because he was really the first person to do it, which was, he said, well, instead of picking one license out there that is available for a free software project, why not pick two and tell the downstream you can use either or both when you distribute further? So the license of Perl, the original Perl 4 and Perl 5, all the way back to Perl 0, I guess, but Perl 4 and Perl 5 in particular, was artistic or GPL v2 or later. Mm-hmm. So you could choose either, actually it was GPLv 1 or later to be exact. You could choose either license or both when you redistribute, which means you can keep passing it along down the same line you have, which is the disjunctive license, both licenses at once, effectively. Or you could take which either
some
fork.
Some people would, and the reason why I stopped is some people will call this dual licensing.
Yeah, I don't call it dual licensing because the term dual licensing is so confusing. In fact, this was the original.
I think disjunctive licensing is somewhat confusing because nobody knows what you...
I often say dual licensing much of the time as well. But the thing is, just for historical purposes, this was the thing that was originally called dual licensing before proprietary relicensing was ever called that. And this is where the term originates, and anybody who says differently... I'm happy to have a debate with you, but you're wrong. because I recall distinctly when this term became into fashion. It was because of Pearl's license, which goes way back into the early 90s.
Okay. Well, I think, this is, you know, maybe this is also an analog to my rationale on saying free and open source most of the time, is that I think if you don't use the term dual licensing, I think people don't know what you're talking about.
Okay. So this is...
So using dual licensing and then... clarifying it, I think.
Disjunctive dual licensing, that's what I like to call it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I say that, I mean the thing that Pearl did first, and I think is actually a really good thing to do for documentation, because it means that if you have longish code examples in the documentation and you're worried, oh shoot, will this be GPL'd when it comes back out of the docs? Well, probably it's fair use, but it can be, right? Mm-hmm. It can come out as GPL because it's under the disjunctive license. Now you probably want to add something to that.
No, I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah. But of course, most of those code examples are going to be fair use anyway, so you probably don't need to worry too much. But it's possible you could have rather long code examples in a document that need a license because they're copyrighted, right? I mean, I would think that would be true.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I can't believe I'm going to say this again. It depends.
Right. Of course it depends. but the situation could happen, so you might as well be prepared for it.
Yes.
Which is why when people ask for a quick answer, I mean, DBS, which is Dan Scott, asked me on Identica. That was my quickest answer for him. I said, well, the simple FDL, still it's going to be some time before FCF has it together. I think the best option right now is GPL or CC BY-SA. With your later clauses on both. I think that's the best stock license if you want a quick answer.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is it's tough to go between, you know, from a software license to a non-software license and vice versa.
That's
the problem. So
going back and forth is hard, but if you just want to go in one direction, sometimes it can
happen. Well, that's why it was so hard to come up with a free documentation. If not, that's the true. FDL and, you know... Yeah.
And you could always try license it. You could always throw in FDL in there as well, if you really want to. If you want to try to make maximum compatibility.
You know, we need to have I don't think we've done this yet. I think we need to have a podcast on the public domain. Because I wouldn't recommend putting your work in the public domain. But a lot of people hearing you say, well, why don't you just try license it, will say, well, hell, why don't I just put it in the public domain?
We should have a podcast on that.
And
but check
it.
But in anticipation of that, check out CC0.
CC0, yeah.
And we'll
That's
talk,
your homework.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about that. It'll probably be a number of episodes before we get a chance, but we will talk more about that in the future. And now we're committed, so we're going to have to.
Eventually.
We will do it before we die, we promise.
I can't promise that.
Well, I think...
No one can make that promise.
That's true, but
yeah.
I made this point before.
I promise I'll try to do it before I die.
But if you're dead, no one's going to be upset at you that you didn't keep the promise.
What was the...
That's my point.
What podcast number is it to say dead in... one of our readers wrote to us and talked about
the... pretty far, because that's a four-digit hex number.
It's really far out, but that's how long I have.
Well, it's a four-digit hex number, so...
A four-digit hex
number.
Basically, the hex number that spells out DEAD, which I should know offhand how many that is, but I don't.
Right, I don't either, so don't feel bad, because I don't either. I like dead beef.
Anyway, well, that's how many episodes I have.
Which is a really long hex number.
It really is.
Dead beef. It's great you can make words out of hex. You can only use A through F, of course, but there's a lot of words that use just A through F.
Well, I think this is a good time for us to close up this segment.
I think so, too. So we talked a lot in the last segment about the FDL questions and the fact that the FSF publishes books.
And it was so exciting because
doing something related to this. It's not specifically related to documentation licensing directly, but it is. Well, I guess it is. Okay.
Yeah. No, it is. And what's fun is that in this segment, we're going to talk about something that we're actually working on, which we can't talk about now, but by the time we air this, we will be able to talk about it. Therefore,
you've heard of embargoes before, right? This is not magic. This kind of thing happens all the time, right?
It's exciting. Well, I understand that, but for me, it's exciting because I don't really get to talk about the things that I'm working on until they're announced, and so now I can let our listeners know, or I'm talking to our listeners before it's announced, even though they won't hear it.
Producer Dan's gonna know.
Producer Dan is going to know. Yeah.
But that's okay.
Producer Dan won't receive it until it's already been published.
Oh, that's true.
Anyway, so I will try to be careful not to say anything that might be inappropriate because the situation may, you know, until we actually do something, you know, you can't, things may change.
Okay, enough disclaimers. Tell us what's going on.
But you don't like the teaser?
It's not a teaser, it's disclaimer. You sound like a lawyer. Tell us what's going on.
Okay, so we're helping the FSF write an objection letter to the Google Book settlement, and by the time this podcast is aired, we should have already filed it with the Southern District of New York.
So can you tell our listeners briefly what the Google Book settlement's doing and what it is?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Google Book settlement is, it's been, most of you have probably heard about it. It's, you know, it's been all over the news recently. So so as you probably know, Google has gone ahead and digitized a lot of books that are in copyright. So they're covered by copyrights that have been claimed by their authors and publishers who have claimed your
No, I'm just listening.
Oh, okay. You're wrinkling your eyebrows, so I thought I had said something.
I'm listening in excitement and anticipation.
Well, I thought
frankly,
because
I've been busy on another project and I haven't followed the news, so some of this is the first time I'm hearing.
So basically, the Authors Guild got together and started a class action to, I'm going to oversimplify all this, to sue Google, basically for copyright infringement.
So when you say it's the Authors Guild, that's basically big copyright, if you will. I mean, that's kind of who that is, right?
Absolutely. Well, basically, so their complaint is, you know, their complaint is, you've digitized all these books, you violated our copyrights, you've made these copies of our books available, and you've, you know, you're making them available in pieces or in whole, and, you know, they're searchable, they're transformed, and, you know, you've basically, violated our copyrights unapologetically. And Google has come back and said, well, actually, this is all covered by fair use. So that's sort of the very basis of the lawsuit. Now, as with most lawsuits, the parties have gone away and started negotiating a settlement. And that happens in a lot of cases, regardless of the merits of the parties. And, you know, if you guys are following our SFLC news, you'll see that when we file lawsuits, they often get settled as well. And it has nothing to do with whether you think that your case will stand up in court. It's that it's very expensive to see a case through, and it doesn't always achieve the result that you'd like at the end of the day. So, or the result that you would think is fair. So you'll negotiate with your adversary to come up with a solution to settle it, to make it go away, that, you know, that you're both comfortable with.
But the settlement, the weird thing about settlements like this, and I remember these things from the 80s with the various VCR lawsuits and so forth, they're settling on behalf of a lot of people who don't kind of have a say in a way. I mean, they do.
So basically they're suing on behalf of all of these authors, and the definition of an author with copyright interest or a publisher, so fitting into the plaintiff class in the different subclasses, so there's an author subclass and a publisher subclass, you know, is actually quite broad. The publisher has to have an exclusive interest, and the author has to have a registered work. You know, and there are some other qualifications as well that they need to meet in order to be in the class. But the class is very expansive, so it encompasses a lot of people. And
so does it actually include anybody who's ever published a book, basically? Or is it not that broad?
It's not that broad, but okay. It's pretty damn broad. So chances are, if you've written a book that's still under copyright that you've registered the work for, you're probably in the class.
Wow, but that's a lot of people. That all that means is you published a book basically since 1976.
No, further back than that. But anyway, but I mean, to be sure, there are some. I'm not going to get into the details of the class, but it's really expansive, and the settlement has actually drawn a lot of, you're in it. Yeah, and the settlement has drawn a lot of complaints because. Because it's so expensive, and they haven't really found a way to, or haven't actually given proper notice to all of the authors or all of the members of the class. So, you know, one of the members of the class filed an objection last week where he actually filed this 47-page, it looks like a brief, even though it's just an objection. And in it, he at length goes on about how the notice, just the notice, is completely inadequate. Mm-hmm. And they're not appropriately notifying copyright owners. Mm-hmm. And.
But so how does this hook up to free software authors? How is like our client space ending
up
in this?
Well, basically, the Free Software Foundation is in the class because the Free Software Foundation is an author.
Right.
The Free Software Foundation is a copyright holder on books that they licensed under the FDL.
Good point.
Right. Well, it's not my point, actually. I should give credit to the FSF where the idea originated. Yeah. But what we're working on, you know, so we confirm that they're in the class. And the interesting thing, so actually to back up a second about the settlement and how it works and what it's about, is that not only is it covering past infringement, but it sets up a regime in order to handle this in the future. So basically,
they set up a
books registry, which acts sort of as like a clearinghouse, mm-hmm. and it gives permission for everyone in the class, that everyone in the class basically grants permission to join a royalty structure in the future for the use of their copyrighted material.
But the FSF books already permit all sorts of redistribution. So where's the conflict come
use,
in?
Use free licensing. They use the FDL. And
which
it
allows
in.
For making money with them and all that
it,
sort of
it,
thing.
It absolutely does. But basically the settlement doesn't contemplate the use of free licenses. So it doesn't require the book rights registry in the future to follow the requirements of those licenses. So all the terms we were talking about before that ensure that the work stays free, they're not required to follow them under the settlement. Well, they're not required to follow them, but the settlement doesn't even think about this issue.
So the whole thing in FDL, like with transparent copies, I guess, mm-hmm. is an issue.
But actually what you can see right away is if you go to Google Books and you take a look at all the books they have up there and you search for one that's covered by the FDL.
Like the GNU Emacs manual.
So yeah, I was just looking at one of the Samba books. So like, you know, any, which isn't an FSF publication, I was just looking at it. Yeah, there are a bunch of O'Reilly books that are there, but that was the one I was just looking at yesterday. And you look at the license page and the FDL requires that the license be included in full. And if you look at it, because the limited preview function, which is used with Google Books, which is presumably there so that they can say, well, it was just for our use. We didn't publish the whole thing. We're encouraging people to buy the book because we omit every mm-hmm. third page. It also omits
every third pages
of the license.
Oh my
so
gosh.
The whole license is not available. So that's the kind of thing that's not acceptable.
Right.
So you've well, got, and the other you've got thing partial I was thinking copies.
Is when I go to Google Books and look at that book, I'm not given a transparent copy.
There's
this whole thing in the, just to explain for our listeners, there's this whole thing in the FDL that talks about transparent versus opaque copies, because the worry was that people would distribute books as PDFs, which really are opaque copies. It's not very easy to edit PDFs, mm-hmm. although you can if you really get into it. Depends on how the PDF was made. If it's a pure scan, you're not able to edit it anyway, even if it's a PDF. So the idea of transparent copies was basically the idea of source code for books, where it's something you could actually edit to generate a new PDF of the book. And of course, FDL, being a copyleft license, requires that transparent copy to accompany the opaque copies, or at least an offer for all that sort of GPL-ish
kind of things. And these just aren't
things.
They just aren't thought about in this situation. They're not mentioned. It's not mentioned
because they assume most of them are all rights reserved, right?
Exactly. Or they assume the authors don't care. But here at issue is something fundamental. It's the idea that, you know, that these books should be licensed freely,
yeah.
and that the licenses need to be respected in order to make sure that stays the case. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting. So actually, Google has put in procedures to implement CC by SA, and that's pretty great. So there are certain books that are CC by SA, you know, you can see that there's a little indicator on the website that says, you know, this book is Creative Commons licensed, and there are, you know, ways that it follows the Creative Commons licensing, but it's not for every book, and it's not for the FDL.
They missed CC by SA books that should be under that system.
I think they probably did, but I don't know for sure. Don't quote me on that.
Right.
And the settlement doesn't talk about that. So the settlement doesn't require them to use that for
Oh, so the settlement basically doesn't require them to comply with the licenses.
Yeah. It imposes this royalty structure, and it basically says, you know, there are different ways that they can make the book available, and the copyright holder can go in and can basically indicate how much they want to be included in the different preview cycles. So in order to follow the free licensing, the copyright holder, after already having licensed their work, has to go in and, you know, has to go affirmatively and increase the percentages to 100% to make sure that the entire book is reproduced. It's interesting. So we're working on a, we're working on an objection letter to say these things.
You're right. This settlement almost sounds like one of those old school RIA deals with the tape companies and stuff. I mean, it sounds
except if you know in the music industry, there's a congressional. I mean, there's legislature on the compulsory licensing scheme. So there's compulsory licensing.
So at least Congress said something.
The legislative process here, it's coming out of a class action settlement.
So they're basically ignoring congressional copyright law.
That's our charge. I mean, that's what I think is the case. It's inappropriate for and a lot.
Not that I'm a fan of copyright law, but I also don't encourage people to ignore the law of the land.
Well, but we've embraced copyright law.
I wouldn't say embraced. We've tolerated it.
We understand that those are the laws right now, and we've studied them, and we've found a way to use them to accomplish our goals, in a way that works very well with the way that the laws have been set up. And then to sort of introduce this through a class action settlement is important. And you'll see that a lot of the complaints about the settlement are that it's an overbroad settlement. It's very aggressive. It's forward looking. It's not talking just about past infringement. It's talking about licensing for future infringement, that the members of the class aren't properly contacted. People don't know there are off orphaned works, and that's a whole nother problem. So it's a mess, but it's fascinating. And this is one small piece that we're helping the FSF work on.
Great. I think it'll be exciting for everybody to look at it, and will be filed publicly so people can read it. Is that how?
Yeah. Well, basically, it's an objection letter is very informal, so you just mail the letter in, and we'll I assume the FSF will publish it at the same time.
Okay. So if it ends up getting something that gets put out publicly, we'll definitely link to it in the show notes.
Great.
And I'll commit to that. I hate committing to linking to the show notes, but I'll do it this time because if it's out there, we should link to it so people can read it in detail. It's really excellent to hear about. It's always good when we can talk about work that we're doing, and it was your work.
Yeah. So it's really mine and others. Yeah. And it's really neat to to be able to talk about.
Would you like
to
thank the Academy? And
they like me. They really like me.
Yeah, then the Hollywood Foreign Press, and I never understood that, you know, on that one award show, the Golden Globes, I guess it is. It was a year my wife watches it. And it was years later I finally asked her, I was like, why does everybody thank randomly the Hollywood Foreign Press? She's like, they run these awards, and I was like. Oh, well, that makes sense that everybody thanks them then.
That's funny.
I didn't even realize that, but yeah.
Well, so, just because so, I like segments, should we wrap up and...
I think that's... I think we're...
And come back to...
Oh, do we need to come back again?
Wrap up. All right, just a second wrap up.
A wrap up of the wrap up. Okay.
That was a fun episode.
Yeah, well, we've covered hopefully a lot of ground. I was glad that Dan asked the question, and it's always good when we can get a whole show out of one question because it gives us some good idea of things to talk about.
And also, it's really great when we can have shows that answer our readers' questions because we know that's what people are interested in. Now, we can't answer every question that we get. We do get a lot of questions, and we try to find the ones that we think have, you know, as much general interest as possible.
Yeah. And documentation licensing is a quagmire, I think, in a lot of ways because it took us so many years to figure out the right licensing schemes for code, and we've got things like the Apache license for the non-copyleft, we've got GPL for copyleft, we've got LGPL for in-between, and that took a lot of time over years of people thinking about this issue of how does software interact with copyright law. With documentation, we didn't really as a community start thinking of the problem heavily basically until the mid-90s. So we're basically 10 years behind most of the time on figuring out what the right thing to do with documentation. And then when you add in this little piece of how documentation interacts with code, you've got a really big thing to think about.
Yes, I think so too. But I think that there are also a lot of other good organizations that are working in this field and quite cooperatively too. So I want to, because we like to pat other organizations on the back. I think the FSF has done awesome work, and Creative Commons as well.
Yeah, and it was good certainly to see the FDL change that made this marriage of FDL and Creative Commons possible, and really solved confusion about Wikipedia. You know, I think it shows a great nobleness of the FSF to say, look, you know, people prefer Creative CC BY-SA. A lot of people do. They should be allowed to move to it. We don't want to hold people to our license.
And it's great that there's two organizations that are quite different.
And have disagreements. You know,
disagreements.
FSF does not like
can work together to get the right licenses for the right situation.
Yeah. So there's it's always good when people work together.
So there you have it. Thanks for joining us. Email us at podcast@softwarefreedom.org.
We haven't mentioned that in a long time. Maybe now we'll get a bunch of emails.
Speak to you next time. The Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license. Was that Festival?
Well, my computer talks to me when something says something in IRC.
That's creepy.